written the Psalm 9. That's who's is it attributed to. And you can learn different things each time you study the different books of the Bible. And one of the things I learned this last time that I hadn't learned when I studied it about 9 years ago is that it's considered an acrostic. And Eddie, correct me if I'm wrong, but the first letter of each sentence contains a letter from the Hebrew alphabet. And I don't think, from what I've studied, it's not a complete acrostic, but for the most part, it does contain the letters of the Hebrew alphabet. So that's kind of interesting. And something else I learned this time around, too, was some people consider that Psalm 9 and Psalm 10 are related, that they're a continuous psalm. And I don't have any feelings one way or another about that, but there's different reasons for and against Psalm 9 and 10 being connected. But we do know that David is the author. Let's go ahead and jump right into it, and let's read the first 8 verses of Psalm 9. I will give thanks to the Lord with all my heart. I will tell of all your wonders. I will be glad and exult in you. I will sing praise to your name, O Most High. When my enemies turn back, they stumble and perish before you. For you have maintained my just cause. You have sat on the throne judging righteously. You have rebuked the nations. You have destroyed the wicked. You have blotted out their name forever and ever. The enemy has come to an end in perpetual ruins, and you have uprooted the cities. The very memory of them has perished. But the Lord abides forever. He has established his throne for judgment, and he will judge the world in righteousness. He will execute judgment for the peoples with equity. What's the first thing that jumps out to you in the first couple of verses here that just captures your attention right away?
David said he praised him with his whole heart.
Yeah. And you know, God doesn't want a half-hearted praise, does he? He wants the whole heart. He wants the whole thing. And so David's offering his praise here to God, the Creator. And when we're happy about something, don't we want to usually tell other people about that? We want to tell them how happy we are about something. And, you know, in the advertising world, it's considered word by mouth. The more people you tell, the more that product is likely to sell, isn't it? So it's important to tell other people how satisfied we are with something. And praising God can spark an interest in others. What else is good about this approach whenever you go full-hearted into something and you're happy about it and you rejoice and you praise something? What's good about it? What all can that lead to? Yeah, they certainly can. They can see the joy in your face. They can see the things going on in your life that might not be going on in their life. They want to know what's bringing that happiness to that person, and we might spark that interest that they might not have had before, just by praising God. And you know, we can also tap that interest and help develop a person's belief in God. They may not even have a belief. They might be an agnostic. They might question the existence of God. They might be an atheist. But they might see something that's a little bit different about one of their coworkers, one of their neighbors, someone else that they know through their kids or something different about that person. And, you know, I believe that we should be that person. We should be that different person that stands out from the world. And again, as George mentioned, he's using his whole heart here to praise God. He doesn't want that half-hearted praise. He wants everything we got. He doesn't want the half full or half empty syndrome, whichever how you look at that. He wants the whole thing filled up. Now he goes on to talk about his enemies in verse 3 here. Who could have been some of David's enemies, either before or during the time that this psalm was written? Who would likely be his enemy? Yeah, Absalom. He ran from several of them, didn't he? And even at one time, you know, Goliath was his enemy. He had several different enemies, and as we will too, from time to time, we'll have people that choose to be our enemy. Hopefully, we don't choose to have someone to be our enemy, but there'll be people that choose to be our enemy, and we see how David reacts to that. But we too, as David does here, we have to trust in God to turn back our enemies, don't we? We have to believe and have that faith that, God's not going to allow the enemies to overtake us in what we're trying to accomplish. And if we don't trust God to vindicate us, then how, you know, we can get into trouble by allowing self-pity and a sense of hatred into our lives. People's going to not see that good person we were just mentioning just a few moments ago. They're going to see somebody different, and then they might not want to be like us then. Grudges can form. What's some other things could happen if people don't see that we're standing out from the other people around us? If we allow our enemies to overtake us, what do other people see about that? What's some of the things that can pop up that scares them off?
See us have anger and frustration.
Okay. And that pretty much shows, doesn't it? It tells on you whenever you're upset about something. You might walk around and just holler at somebody or just frown all the time, or it might lead you to sin in some way, different ways that you might hold that grudge. You want to get back at that person. And those are the ways we need to avoid. And David, you know, he talks about his enemies here, but we're going to see in more detail here in a minute how he actually talks to them. It's actually the enemy that is going to bring their own downfall. Yes?
It's interesting. You commented just a few moments ago, spark of thought I've never thought of before. But it kind of fits here with verse 3 when he says, they fall and perish at your presence, not mine. And what you said something, and it just got me to thinking to the fact, you know, when you mentioned Absalom, Saul, and Goliath. I think I'm right in this, just I was running through it in my head. But there were two different types of enemies that David had. He dealt with those enemies differently. Those that were outside of Israel, God's people, he was the warrior king. Goliath, it was a frontal attack. All the countries round about him, it was a frontal attack. He was right there in their face. But when the enemies were of God's
his family.
People, the family of God, he ran and he left it in God's hands. I don't know what to make of that, because I've never thought of that before. Just a comment that you made, the way you put all those together, just had me think about that.
Yeah.
But the warrior king ran when the enemies were within the family, the spiritual family, without the spiritual, and then he left it in God's hands, and God provided for him and took care of it. But when they were without the family, the spiritual family, he was indeed the warrior king. He took care of business.
That's a good point. Good comment. Any other? Yeah, Kevin. Yeah.
For lack of a better term, because what you might be doing might be unsafe, or it might be costing money or whatever, so you're a little more aggressive than you are with your brothers and sisters. And David was probably the same way, being a king. There were times with things with the kingdom that he probably had to do. So I think that's a great point. Yeah. That, you know, I think we do it though with our lives today.
All right.
And
let's hope not.
and
Yeah, it's important to recognize that relationship with each other, the different possibilities that we have in those relationships. Good points. Anything else? Any other observations or comments?
It would kind of give the Christians a bad name if they'd done that to their own people. If somebody was outside looking in, they'd say, well, I don't
know. Yeah, why would I want to be a part of that? Yeah. That's good. Verses 5 and 6, they give us a good glimpse into the power of God. You know, some we know and we've heard, we sing about all the time how powerful God is, but, you know, until you actually start reading His Word or reading about Him, sometimes we just might miss focus a little bit on how powerful He is. But verses 5 and 6 says, "You have rebuked the nations. You have destroyed the wicked. You have blotted out their name forever and ever. The enemy has come to an end in perpetual ruins, and you have uprooted the cities. The very memory of them has perished." There's a permanent destruction being talked about here, isn't there? There's destruction, and it's going to be lasting destruction. And, you know, we've all seen this, the side effects, the effects of war, different things that have happened, damage that can be caused. We can see the aftermath of an area after bombs have just blown it to smithereens. But cities, they can be rebuilt from the destruction of man's weapons, can't they? We've seen that happen time and time again. We see bad weather, a tornado go through a town and tear it up, and, you know, people are right back out there that next day putting back up their houses and gathering up what they had, and they're starting over again. Well, when God issues His final destruction, that's it, isn't it? That's permanent. And that's how powerful God is, and that jumps out to me in this section here. No human hand is going to be able to rebuild what God destroys permanently. It's going to be gone. And no wicked person is going to be able to escape His judgment. And you know what? All the possessions that belong to men, they're going to be destroyed too. It's not just the man or the possessions. It's both, isn't it? It's going to be all of that that's going to be destroyed. But the Lord's going to endure forever, and His judgment will not include corruption. It's not going to be, there are not going to be debates on what's wrong, what's right. You know, God, let's have a debate about this. That's not it. God's already made His decision. He's left everything that we need right here in His Word, and He doesn't want us to debate Him. It will be a righteous judgment. Any comments? Okay, let's read verses 9 through 14. "The Lord also will be a stronghold for the oppressed, a stronghold in times of trouble. And those who know Your name will put their trust in You, for You, O Lord, have not forsaken those who seek You. Sing praises to the Lord who dwells in Zion. Declare among the peoples His deeds, for He who requires blood remembers them. He does not forget the cry of the afflicted. Be gracious to me, O Lord. See my affliction from those who hate me. You who lift me up from the gates of death, that I may tell of all Your praises." The Lord can be our refuge each and every day, can't He? What do you typically think of when somebody says, you know, I need a refuge, I need a place to go, I need to get away for a while? You know, you might want to get away for some rest and relaxation. There might be a trip that you have planned, or you might have just got back from a trip like Billy did. You know, there might be places that you just need to go to get away from things. And we think of it as rest and relaxation. And if that place is popular, you know, we got to make reservations weeks or maybe months ahead of time to even get into that place. And with God, we can turn to Him anytime, can't we? Day or night, we can turn to God anytime in our life, and He's there for us. And He puts His arms around us. He shields us from the dangers. He protects us. He offers so much more than what man and man's possessions can offer. And then He picks us up when we fall. And He even carries us through the rough waters. You know, sometimes it's not all easy going. It's not easy being a Christian. It's not easy living next door to people sometimes that you might not get along with so good. It might not be easy to work with the people at work that you know, they see things a different way than you do, and they give you hardship from time to time. It's not always easy. But with God, we always have that refuge. And we can call out to our Father just exactly like David did right here in this passage. David did that very thing here. And we have Christ that carries our message through prayer. You know, he mentions a stronghold or a high tower here. It's a permanent protection from something. Something can't get to you in that high tower of safety, the security that you have, that only God can provide. It's a stronghold that no one on the ground can get to. And God offers that here. And David helps us realize it here many years later after he wrote this. He helps us all to understand that even today. In verse 10, where it says, the latter part of verse 10, it says, "For you, O Lord, have not forsaken those who seek you." What does forsake mean?
Depart, leave.
Okay. Depart, leave. Have nothing to do with. It means he's going to leave us. It means to give up on. It means to abandon. It means you won't have that anymore. It's forsaken. And when he says he will not leave us, he means he will not leave us, doesn't he? He doesn't tease around about this. He's there for us to turn to. And it's possible, though, for us to forsake God, isn't it? You know, it says God's not going to forsake us, but if you turn back around, we can forsake him, can't we? How do we forsake him? What's some of the ways that we can forsake God?
Not going to church. Not living a godly life.
Those are two prime examples there. What's some more lesser seen that maybe there might be things that people don't see that we've forsaken God, but maybe we really have. What's some ways that we might forsake him in that way?
Quit studying the word.
Yeah.
Like the Israelites did, you know, in the time of the young king, lost his name right now, but 8 years old. But Josiah. They found the book, and they lost the book. And they didn't have a clue what God was going to say to them.
Yeah. Yeah, we forsake God when we turn away from his truth, the knowledge that is there for us, the knowledge that we can only find in God, and we abandon our responsibility of faithfulness too, don't we? We give that up. We forsake him. We put that behind us and say, you know, today I really don't want any part of you. I've got my own life to take care of. And we forsake God. It might seem like just, you know, maybe an hour or maybe a day. But what if that was the last hour or the last day that's in our life, you know, that forsaking, that becomes permanent then, doesn't it? So we have to be careful with that. And isn't it usually something that we're closer drawn to that draws us away? I mean, you know, you can't just dream up ways that you want to forsake God because it doesn't happen like that. You don't want to forsake God, but there's ways that you can be drawn away from God. One or the other. Yep. And instead of repelling from sin, we're attracted to sin, aren't we? Like a magnet. We have a magnet expert here that knows a lot about magnets, but it's something we should be opposed to, but actually it attracts us, doesn't it? For some reason, something stands out to us, and we think, "Well, I sure would like to have that." And I know it would make some changes in my life, where it probably wouldn't be real pleasing to everybody, but for most of the people, you know, it should be okay. But we can't do that, can we? What does it mean to know the Lord?
To love him.
Okay, if you know the Lord, you will love him, won't you? What's some other ways that we... Okay, service. What else?
Keeping his commandments.
You know, we're going to be faithful, aren't we? We're going to be obedient. We're going to be confident. We're going to have a high level of confidence whenever we know the Lord. I think through the years, the different people that I've known, that, you know, there's some that they're going to raise your level of confidence just because that you know they're going to be consistent in what they say and what they do, and you can have confidence. If they tell you something, it's going to happen. And that's the same kind of confidence we can have in God. Kevin, did you have a comment? Rituals.
There's, you know, requirements and things we have to do, obviously. But when we meet our judgment, God's going to look at us for who we are based on our abilities and our strengths and all of that individually by our obedience to Him. And all of us, you know, not everyone has the same skill set and ability. But He is going to look at us to, as our effort and our and I think that's what makes, in a lot of ways, Christianity, or I guess being a Christian, a great thing, is because we have forgiveness and we have all that, but we also we don't all have the same expectation. And I don't want to say that we don't have to do the same thing, but there are.
Well, it's putting your faith into action.
But
Right.
But at the same time, I think too many times everybody says, oh, you checked the block, I did these four things, I'm done. Yeah. And it doesn't work that way, which I'm glad it doesn't. Because sometimes fulfilling that list can be challenging. Yeah.
Good thoughts. Yes.
You think each Christian should live up to his highest capabilities and try to get beyond? Is that?
I would think so. Wouldn't you?
Because you know your own capabilities. You know, everybody else don't know.
And sometimes we put ourselves down here, though, with our capabilities. And I remember a sermon being preached years and years ago, not too long after I became a Christian, that, you know, there's going to be some things that's harder for us to reach, and we're going to maybe get on a ladder and reach up to those things, and we're going to stretch out a little bit and get to those things. Right. God didn't say only do this if it's easy to you, did He? So there's going to be some things out there that challenges, and we're going to have to rise up to those challenges. Anything else? Okay, verse 11 offers us some great advice. Yes?
I didn't want to say anything because I didn't know if you were going to get to this or not. Verse 10 is really, really powerful. You mentioned the fact that it says that God's not going to forsake us. First, we have to, and what you see in verse 10 is really a progression here for the child of God. It starts with a knowing. And knowing, I compare that to like in a marriage, a husband and wife, since Paul does that. Yeah. I know what upsets Dina, and I know what makes her happy, and all I have to do is whatever that is to get the reaction that I want. And we have to know God in that way. We have to know Him that well that we know what's going to make Him happy and what's going to upset Him. And the only way that comes is through the Word of God. And then it leads to the second progression in verse 10, is that we got to trust Him. Because as we know God and as we understand Him, He requires of us to do certain things. And a lot of times, I mean, that's what Hebrews 11 comes in here, is because we can't see God. We can't see heaven. Nobody has ever seen that. Well, one has. And we just have His witness, but He's not alive any longer on the earth. So we have to take on faith everything that's in here.
That's the definition of faith, isn't it?
Not at that point that God is happy with us, actually. Because the last step in verse 10 is word seek comes from a Hebrew word which means actively looking for, like we would do if we lost our car keys, if we lost our cell phone. We just don't sit around and think about it. But we're actually up looking for those because they're a necessity of our lives, and so is God, a necessity in our life. It's at that point that he's not going to forsake us.
That's good.
It's at that point that he's not going to forsake us. And so we need to understand that if we're going to have a relationship with him and the kind that David had, we got to know him, we got to trust him, and we got to seek him. Then he won't forsake us. And this just reminds me of James 2. Faith without works is dead. That's really what David is saying.
It's an act of faith.
Differently than James did.
Good point. Good point.
I was thinking about him forsaking us. If you look at what David did, when he sinned against Bathsheba and all that, he actually didn't forsake David at that time. He actually gave him opportunity to repent. And I was just thinking about God. And in that faith, and I agree with what Brother Eddie said, but I've also seen, even when we forsake God, he doesn't forsake us. He still carries us as long as he gives us breath.
And I'm so thankful for that too, aren't you?
Amen.
I am. Verse 11 offers us some great advice here. David says to sing praises and to tell everyone what God has done for you. And God's done so many things, where would you even begin to tell somebody about what God's done for you? Do you first tell about him creating the heavens and the earth and all the greatness that was there? Do you tell them about he's got some commandments that we're supposed to follow? Is that where you start? Or perhaps you tell how he saved 8 people from a great flood that destroyed the whole world. Or maybe you start off by telling that person that, you know, God sent us somebody here on this earth. And you may not know him yet, but you'll get to know him. But he sent somebody here on this earth that can be our Savior. You know, where do you start whenever you start to tell somebody about God? There's so many things that you can say to tell somebody about God. Verse 12, it tells us that the Lord will also be an avenger of blood. The person who causes the death of another person, they're going to have a righteous judge, aren't they? And that's the only way to have it. They're going to have a righteous judge. We also learn this in verse 9. The cry of the humble, where the afflicted will not go unnoticed. And people is going to receive their just reward or punishment because we do have a righteous judge. And those who cause somebody else to take their focus off of something, to jump into sin, you know, I'm pretty sure that those people are going to be punished because they're leading others into sin. And when I think about, you know, you can think of zillions of examples, but you think about focus. You know, you think about you're driving down the road in the middle of the night and this deer jumps out of the woods and crosses right in front of you, slam your brakes on, the deer just kind of trots off across the road. You kind of look at that deer. It might be a great big buck or something. It's walking off to the side. You're focused on that deer for a little bit. It might be taking your focus off these other 5 or 6 deer that's coming right behind it that's going to jump and hit your car. You know, there's different things that can lead your focus away, and it's important to always keep your focus on God. People might try to get us to focus on something that's shiny and say, you know, you're going to be successful if you have this or that. And by doing so, they might cause us to lose our focus on the really important things that God expects from us. And we're told here that he's going to punish all things evil. But I'm thankful. I am thankful that we have a righteous judge. I'm so thankful for that. Any comments? Looking again at verses 13 and 14, you know, David, I think here, he's asking for some help, and he wants to be able to tell even more people about his God, doesn't he? In a previous psalm, David asked that he might live in order to be able to rejoice and to worship God. And God, he's going to give each one of us a different situation. Some of them are going to be easy situations that, you know, it's grade school kind of thing to get out of. Others, it might cause us to have to think a little bit, like Eddie was referring to a while ago. We're going to have to study. We're going to make sure that we know a little bit more than what the grade school person does about a certain sin or a certain situation. So we're going to be faced with different situations, and it'd be different to, it'd be interesting to see how everybody's going to respond. I remember a few years ago, several years ago now, because I'm getting older than what I thought it was last time I taught this. I was given a responsibility every now and then of being over like a dozen people in the shop that I worked in. And you send them out on their jobs, you have a briefing in the morning, you send them out on their jobs, give them each a different thing to do. And sometimes they would come back and ask for help. And they didn't even need any. Well, they just wanted somebody to work with. They didn't want to be lonely all day. Or you might give a bunch of jobs out and somebody didn't come back for help, but they needed the help. Well, they didn't want you to know that they didn't know how to do the job or something. They needed somebody else there with them to, so that they could be able to do the job. And we have to be able to recognize when we need that help. You might have a problem that I can help you with that nobody else can, or it might be vice versa on that. I can help you, or you can help me. It works both ways. But when we ask God to help us, He knows exactly what we really need. And He knows that some of us are going to be able to bear more burdens than others. And He knows that there's going to be some people there that are going to need more help. Okay, I want to jump into, we're running out of time here. I want to jump into verses 15 through 20 to finish this up. The nations have sunk down in the pit. I think I didn't read all of verse 14. Let me finish verse 14. Let me start with verse 14. That I may tell of all your praises, that in the gates of the daughter of Zion I may rejoice in your salvation. The nations have sunk down in the pit which they have made, in the net which they have hid. Their own foot has been caught. The Lord has made himself known. He has executed judgment. In the work of his own hands, the wicked is snared. The wicked will return to Sheol, even all the nations who forget God, for the needy will not always be forgotten, nor the hope of the afflicted perish forever. Arise, O Lord, do not let man prevail. Let the nations be judged before you. Put them in fear, O Lord. Let the nations know that they are but men. Selah. This section is laying out exactly what wicked people can expect. And, you know, some people might call it the boomerang effect. What goes around comes around, or we just know that things are going to happen. If we do something bad, you can pretty much guarantee that something's going to happen to us, pretty much certain. And he's saying here that the wicked sinner will die a wicked death. In verse 16, what's the proper pronunciation of the Haggad? How do you pronounce that, Eddie? And at the end of verse 16, Haggai. This means to meditate or think about it for a while. And Selah, that's used there as well, is a pause, mostly in music. And David's saying here that this is something really important. And don't skip over it. God doesn't want us to forget this. He doesn't want us to treat it lightly. We need to pause. We need to reflect. We need to meditate on it. We have to be careful. And we're going to get better results when we think about something for a while, aren't we, instead of just jumping into it? You think about building a house, you're going to start with your foundation. Well, if your foundation is crumbling, then the structure on top of it isn't going to stand up for very long, is it? It's going to fail too. So we need to be very careful how we construct, starting with the foundation. Looking at verse 17, this verse is very blunt and to the point. This is a verse we should all go back to from time to time. The wicked will return to Sheol, even all the nations who forget God. This is just going to let us know how severe the punishment is, and we cannot belittle that at all. It is huge. The punishment is huge. It's the difference between heaven and hell. It's a difference between God and Satan, and we cannot belittle that at all. You know, sometimes when we're a child, we see things that it's much larger than what it really is. I remember when I was a kid in our backyard, you know, we hit a softball over the fence. It was a home run. It was a big deal for all the kids. It's like, wow, he hit a ball over the fence. But when I drive by and look at that house today, it's just a 50-foot by 50-foot backyard. It's a very small yard. I thought, wow, I could have probably hit over the house. You know, it's just, it's a small yard. And we can't belittle things. I think the more we help each other, and the longer we're a Christian, the more we realize how little the little things are and how big the big things are. And we have to put our heart and our soul into it, and it can't be half-hearted, as was mentioned at the beginning of this psalm. Any questions or comments? Verse 18 is very interesting here. For the needy will not always be forgotten, nor the hope of the afflicted perish forever. There's various reasons for the poor people being written about for thousands of years. If God did not have a concern for them and thought that we didn't need poor people in our lives or afflicted people in our lives, there wouldn't be any, would there? And even Jesus did not rise to be a rich person. He grew up as a just a common person, so people could understand who he was. And I think God's left a message here for us when we're thinking about the poor. The presence of people with needs gives us an opportunity to exhibit our faith that we wouldn't be able to exhibit as we're commanded. Because we're told numerous times we're supposed to help the afflicted. So God gives us, we should look at that as opportunities, and we should take those opportunities and help those people. Yes.
Absolutely agree with that. But I also point out that the word for forgotten in verse 18 is the same word for forsaken in verse 10. So I think the implication here is that these poor that we're talking about are the children of God. And they are not forgotten. They are not forsaken. You've already said that. But continuing with your analogy there, you know, who is it that we are first of all supposed to help in the New Testament? Those of the household of faith. Mm-hmm. Often than not, and I've heard this comment. I've heard this comment every congregation I've ever been in. We need to help our own first. And unfortunately, a lot of times that phraseology is used concerning the local congregation. But when I look in the, I'm glad that the Christians in Antioch didn't feel that way, but extended the help first and foremost to the Christians in Jerusalem over there in the book of Acts, because they were in worse shape than those in Antioch. And those in Antioch were in pretty bad shape. The Macedonian brethren as well, to help those with Jerusalem. So our help should be extended to anybody, any child of God in the world, primarily and first of all.
Good comment. Anything else before we close? You know, David says we're only men, and no matter how many men are in a nation, they're still weak. In comparison to God's strength, we're just weak. We are very weak people. And then David closes the psalm with the word to pause, Selah, as if to say, there, what do you think about that? What do you think about what we just read? And I'm thankful that we have Psalm 9 to study from, and I'm thankful for y'all to be here tonight to contribute to the discussion. Next week, we have a visitor. And we won't be in Psalms, but we'll pick back up again the following week. And I can't remember. I think Duke's teaching the week after next, but I can't remember for sure. I can't remember which Psalm that is right now. Anyway, thank you all.